Everyone has a story. You don't have to come from some legacy or come from some person that changed history. Every single person at home has someone that's connected who decided to make a pivot that made a ripple effect for your life and then made you why you're here.
We've always been a people that would look at what was done before us to fuel us into what we're gonna do moving forward. So the reason why Black history to me is so important is knowing what we come from can embolden us and inspire us into where we're supposed to go. And there's a place here waiting for you. For your business,
yeah, we're on the Lord's time, sharing his love and his life. Welcome to another episode of Brothers in the Foyer. My name's Andrew. I'm here with my brothers Isaiah, Will, Crispin, and Mo. Our other brother wasn't able to be here today. Christian, we'll see you. We'll see you later on the next episode. Before we get started, we want to give a shout out to our sponsor, Serve Clothing. Serve Clothing has many different clothing options that you can choose from. They have dress shirts. It's that shirt with the vents where if you're a missionary or if you work in the office, it's in a hot day, you don't have to worry about sweating and having those sweaty tacos in your armpits. You can have vents where you can be able to breathe. If you have missionaries that are serving in a hot climate, a humidity climate, they can be able to wear this and still be able to do their work effectively and not sweat through and look disgusting. So get some of those shirts, use our code FOYERFAM and be able to get a discount in the checkout. As well as we want to say an exclusive thank you to those people that have donated to our podcast so far. Thank you so much. You can see their names here coming down. We just want to give a shout out to your support for helping us from day one and watching and subscribing and liking our videos. And then speaking of that, if you are a fan of our stuff and our things, but you have not subscribed, go ahead and press that button down below and subscribe to our podcast and share it with your friends and your family if this episode is something that you think someone would like. So let's go ahead and get into it. We're going to be talking about Black history because obviously it's Black History Month. From a Latter-day Saint perspective, as well as from a United States perspective, and why it's so important, and highlighting some important people that some of you viewers at home may not know of or never heard of. And I think some of us here are going to be enlightened as well, because though it's Black history, we may not know everything, but we can be inspired and learn from one another. So I think this is going to be a really great episode. Hope you guys are tuned in, and let's go ahead and get into it. The first person I kind of wanted to highlight and talk about, I don't know, are you guys familiar with Brown versus Board of Education?
Most definitely.
Yeah. Absolutely. So foundational Supreme Court case, you know, this helped reverse the Plessy versus Ferguson Supreme Court case where separate was equal. That was the belief for like 60 years leading up to until Brown. And the cool thing about the Brown versus Board of Education is that it helps integrate schools. And there's a story. The crazy thing about the story is that it's totally misrepresented. It's totally recorded wrong. A lot of the things they put in there in the history books that I've read growing up, it's not the full story. Mm. And the reason I know is because it's my family. My grandmother is Linda Brown and Oliver Brown that the story is focused on is my great grandfather. And so I've been able to hear it firsthand of the true story from the people's lips who are actually there and who actually lived it. The story actually goes like this. So everyone thinks that like Oliver Brown took his daughter and walked straight into the all white school and said, enroll my daughter. And if not, I'm going to sue y'all. Mm-hmm. And it made him look like this Superman hero and everything. And though it was courageous for him to do that, it was a lot more backstory to that. So there was a lot of other NAACP was trying to do this for years. They tried to do it in North Carolina, Virginia, and there was like, I think 12 other cases they tried to do, but it didn't go anywhere in the lower courts. And so the cool thing about this is that they were looking around at other schools and other places. The main one obviously is where in Topeka, Kansas, and this is where they were able to recruit 13 plaintiffs, including my grandmother and my great grandfather. They wanted the parents, these Black parents, to take their kids and try to enroll them in all white school. They obviously knew they weren't going to be able to be enrolled just because they're Black and it was segregation at that time. But the crazy thing about it is that they wanted that to kind of provoke and give a reason so they can be able to sue the Topeka Board education system. And by them doing that, they're able to create this case. And so one of the reasons why is because my grandmother, she lived, what, like four blocks away from the all-white school. Mm-hmm. And instead of just being able to walk directly to the school, she had to actually walk, I think, about a mile and a half and then go across a switchyard of train tracks, right? Mm. And then wait at a bus stop for like an hour to 45 minutes, like 6 o'clock in the morning. And it's like rain, sleet, snow, cold, freezing. You're not wearing pants. So you got a skirt on and you're waiting there and then get bused all the way to the other side of school, right? And so obviously this isn't wrong. This isn't right. You could just go to a school that's right down the street from you. And obviously these were things that were happening with other children in the area as well. And, obviously they didn't think that was right. And so they were able to, take this to the Supreme Court, and Thurgood Marshall was a lawyer at the time. Everyone knows who that guy is. Sure. He spoke on behalf of them and pretty much fought against that. And it took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And, it became the kind of, I would say, kind of like the foundation for all the other civil rights things that happened. It was like a platform, like a trampoline for everyone else. It inspired Rosa Parks. She talked about it. She's like, okay, we're able to integrate schools now, separate but equal is not equal at all. And then also inspired another guy we all know about, Martin Luther King.
Right.
And he spoke about Brown versus Board as being that foundational win for them to be able to integrate transportation and then eventually everything else and why we're sitting here today. So a fun, cool story that a lot of people don't really realize has a foundational effect and domino effect on the rest of the civil rights period. And so that's kind of my little thing. I don't know if you guys knew that or were surprised about that at all.
Yeah. Was Ruby Bridges before that or after?
I believe it was after, because she was able to integrate the schools. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe probably it was so. After.
Yeah, it sounded like
a lot of people actually confuse her with Linda Brown too. It's kind of funny just because it's another little black girl going into school. But
right.
Because that integration happened, she was able to go in and go into the schools and all throughout, I think, down in the South. And then everyone else was able to do that. So this affected everyone. So if you're at home and you didn't know about Brown versus Board, you're in school with other black kids, you got friends from school, it's because of that, you know? And I think it's a great thing all of us need to learn and realize that those have foundational effects for our everyday life. And it's become like a basis for a lot of other Supreme Court cases as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, a ripple effect from drinking fountains to being in restaurants and schools and just everything, especially at that time period where we were divided and separated. So yeah, that's really foundational.
You know, the crazy thing is that people in Topeka, like that separate but equal thing, everyone thought that was cool. Like the black folks, they didn't actually want to integrate because they had their own pharmacies, they had their own banks, they had their own everything.
That's what I heard, yeah.
But down in the South, I think things were hugely wrong. Way different. Yeah. They had less resources and things like that for like the black schools and everything. But my grandmother, she was telling me, she's like, we had just as good enough stuff as everyone else. We had black teachers. We had great resources. I think it changes per state and location, but Kansas was a state that had fairly good things. And a lot of people think it was all just hate and everything, but black people did their own thing. White people did their own thing and they just stayed to themselves.
Mm. So for me and for our audience context, who don't know this, around what years was this?
Oh, sorry. I didn't even give the year. Sorry. This is 1954. So like the 1951 to 1954, when the case was won in May 17th, 1954. So it was like a 4 or 5 year period of them trying to go throughout this whole part to the court case being done. But yeah, so early 50s.
Gotcha.
Yeah. How old was your grandmother at the time?
So she was about 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
So elementary school. And you would think that all the stuff that you're kind of getting thrown into, she came like the poster child of the whole case, you know? And so photographers are in her face, paparazzi was all just knocking on their door every other day, Time Magazine and stuff like that, just in her face every single day. And it was, I had to be kind of traumatic for a kid to just put on the front page of everywhere. Yeah. And then also the name Brown, their name only became the center of the case just because one, it was B, and then my great grandfather was the only guy representing the whole group.
Oh,
so it was all mothers. Yeah. It was all mothers representing. So 13 or 12 mothers, and my great grandfather was the only man. And I thought that would help with the case, would be having a man represent the rest of everybody. So that's really the only reason that he was kind of like front and centered, because they used his name. And then obviously the child is like, okay, she's the center of it. And they just focused on her. And he was reluctant actually to even do it, 'cause he didn't want all the attention.
Yeah.
Mm. My great grandmother, his wife, actually talked him into actually going and enrolling my grandmother in.
Wow.
'Cause he didn't want to have no trouble. He was just like, no, I don't want our family to be threatened. I don't want none of this. And she's like, you got to think about not only your child now, but think about your grandkids, your children, your descendants from here. You're going to be helping change something. And hey, shout out to the strong mothers out there, strong wives. If it wasn't for her, he wouldn't have probably acted. So,
wow.
Love you, absolutely. Anna. No, Linda Brown, like you said, her story, or, you know, her part in that, that case was in 1954. Ruby Bridges, her case happened in 1960. So it was about 6 more years after that. But that case that Linda Brown was part of is what paved the way for what happened with Ruby Bridges to be possible.
Right.
Because their story, you know, that was the legal forefront. You know, they had to go into the Supreme Court and win that case, win that lawsuit for things to be changed. And once it was, it then allowed, you know, desegregation across the South to kind of start happening. But, you know, it makes sense that across the South, it took a little while for, you know, those things to go into place. So, like, their stories are similar, with Linda Brown's being part of that gigantic case that changed the United States forever. Mm-hmm. And then with Ruby Bridges, hers was more, you know, in the South, desegregation was also opposed, but it was a lot more overt, a lot more in your face, a lot more hatred was involved, a lot more physical damage, violence, and the whole nine, as opposed to, not like there wasn't any going on in Kansas at the time as well, but you know, the South does have its reputation for
it. Kansas, you know, was a free state anyway, so it was like already kind of a safe haven in a way.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it was
the North. Yeah. Yeah.
So it was.
And that's why it was so crucial that it happened. It happened in a place where this could happen.
Right.
You know, if it was down in Alabama, this may not have even been a thing.
Right.
You know.
Now, was Ruby Bridges also in that integration of the educational system? Is that kind of what her thing was as well?
Yeah. So Ruby Bridges, her story was, you know, she was in New Orleans, Louisiana. So her story was there. And, you know, it took place after the case was won in 1954. But during the implementation phase of that desegregation, she became the first African-American child to integrate in an all-white school in a deeply segregated South area. So
yeah.
Ruby Bridges is a bit more famous, I guess, because of the nature of her first day after integrating into this all-white school in Louisiana. It was such an ordeal that National Guard was called in.
Yeah, to walk her into
the school. She walked into the school basically by herself. She was the only student there, or one of a small handful that was there, but she was the only student there for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And she had to walk through literally a mob. Mm-hmm. And protected only by military from not physically being accosted on her way to the doors. And it was just all over the news, and it was just in everybody's face, because it was such a big deal that this was happening in such a deeply segregated area. So Ruby Bridges' situation was, she's so young, facing all this actual, like, verbal abuse, physical abuse, this emotional abuse just happening on TV. Everybody in the world was tuning into that. Whereas with Linda Brown, she was part of the actual forefront case that opened the door for desegregation.
For the way, yeah.
And yeah. So, I mean, these women, man, it's not a surprise that, especially with the educational system, that women are at the forefront of us being able to be educated in the way that we are now. So,
yeah.
Deeply inspired by these two, for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's really important too for our audience to know. That's why we're wanting to do this episode and discuss these individuals in our history, because it's not just what was accomplished through, you know, their efforts and basically creating something that was completely not normal in the time they lived in. You know, segregation was heavy, and it was just the way of life. And so I feel it's important to just recognize that we want to highlight these individuals and their accomplishments because of the great faith and courage that they displayed in basically creating a whole new way of life. So that way, that word equal can really be, I guess, felt and felt, because they said it was separate but equal, but segregation is never equal, you know, if we're divided, you know, like you mentioned something I didn't know, like in terms of like the black schools, the black businesses that were owned and the African Americans at that time were just like living in their sphere, and then white people were living in their sphere, and they were separate, but they basically enjoyed the same rights in their ecosystem, right? Yeah. And in their sphere, but there was still a division in our country, you know, and in our nation, that necessarily you can't really be equal if there's still like that division there.
True.
And so that was something new to me. I didn't know the way of life was as it was then.
Yeah. And in some areas that was just the way of life. It was, everyone was living equal. Everyone was doing their own thing. They were industrious and everything, but just being able to not to integrate and really mingle with each other, that everyone just kept their space and say, you do your thing, I'll do my thing, you know? But it's crazy. It's just like, we wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for these people.
Yeah.
People like to think like, what's the point of Black History Month? They're learning about these people, but y'all wouldn't be hearing us on YouTube right now or listening to us right now if it wasn't for this, you know? So it's always good to give homage to those people who've sacrificed all and did everything so that we can be able to be here, you know, and be able to share these great things that have changed our lives and affected our family, you know.
Yeah,
absolutely. They would have had to find us on the dark web.
And I don't want to go too far off the path of highlighting our figures, but I do want to ask, had these individuals that we're talking about today and not discussing not done what they've done to create what we can enjoy today as African Americans, do you think we would be at this point? Like, what would have had to happen if there weren't these courageous individuals who basically, you know, exercised their great faith and rights? Like, would we be at this point, or what would have had to happen if it weren't for these specific individuals, do you think?
I look at it like this, knowing the stock that we come from and knowing the type of people that we come from. These are the examples that have the most notoriety. But what's important to remember about these people in particular is that they weren't alone. These cases right here with Brown versus Board of Education, and then, you know, with Ruby Bridges and where she was, and all the other stories that we're going to bring up here, they were the embodiment of a community that was fed up. They were the embodiment of people in a larger group tired of the status quo. So my theory is, had it not been these people, I like to think that it would have been someone else. Yeah. Just knowing the type of perseverance that we come from, coming from slavery to still be able to flourish, coming from the results of slavery and how people thought of us to still be able to flourish. Coming from, you know, the early late 1800s into the early 1900s, and that transition into the industrial age and things like that, and Black people trying to find their way still here in America. I think that if it wasn't these people who we are grateful for, I do have the strong feeling that it would have been, you know, somebody else. And it makes me wonder, if it was someone else, would we be further along? Would we be not as far along? But I'd like to think that if it wasn't these wonderful people, other strong people like them would have stepped up and taken on the challenge as well. But that's just my two cents. I really feel like we still would have fought the way that we tend to fight, to try to at least just get a seat at the table.
Right. No, I think it's human. Great. I think it's human nature to always try to do better than I don't think we're born to settle. You know, we're supposed to innovate. Look at where we're at now versus 50 years ago, 60 years ago. We innovate, we grow. I think it's a part of our DNA and who Heavenly Father made us.
Yeah. You
know, we're supposed to leave things better than we found it. We're creators. We that's just what we do, you know? Yeah. And I think, yeah, just as you're saying, Crispin, I think it would only be a matter of time someone who was going to revolutionize something or step in and step up about, hey, this isn't right. We need to change this, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy when you...
No, go for it.
I was just going to say, it's crazy when you look at history, because it's like when people have freedom, if you have the, you know, you're able to exercise your freedom, freedom of religion. Like when you look at, like I'm a history buff, so I like to take that lens of history. Like if you look at like when Jesus Christ was alive to when the printing press happened, that was like what, 1500 years?
Yeah.
You know, and someone's going to be like, that, it was 1300. Yeah, right.
Fact check that.
But like, as soon as you know, America was founded and people, not everybody, obviously, but people that got freedom to exercise and their rights, and people were able to, you know, test and try new things. Mm-hmm. All the technological advances that happened in the last, what, 200 years? Like, if you think about it, cars weren't around 150 years ago, you know? So in the wider scope of history, all these things are relatively, you know, like they're in their infancy.
Yeah.
Right. And, mm-hmm. and even for, you know, like I'm excited for the future for people of color in general, because I'm excited to see like what we do now that we have full rights compared to, you know, our past in this country. It's kind of an exciting thing to think about, like, okay, what's next? Where are we going to get to? Like, we always have that spirit of innovation in us, yeah. to get and achieve more.
Yeah, that's awesome. Now, you guys, yeah, so just the progressive of humanity, the progressive attitude that we have to always improve, I think, was a huge highlight for me from listening to you fellas. So yeah, that makes me very optimistic about the future, especially with some of the things we're seeing now. I'm not getting into the political fear, but there's things out there that people are like, oh, certain people are like gonna set us back, you know, 50 years or whatever on the whole race thing. But no, just seeing where we were and how things are moving forward, that definitely gives me a lot of optimism, you know,
for
in
sure.
terms of also, things can be better.
It, just to tag on with that, that phrase in and of itself is just mind-boggling, because when you look at the point Moses made, to set us back 50 years, there's so much to undo.
Much has to be done.
that's heavy work.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
that's big time. But the one thing I didn't want to add on, especially with the optimism moving forward, is that we, as Black people coming from where we come from ancestrally, ancestors is huge in Black culture, no matter what country you're in. Knowing where you come from, knowing what your predecessors went through, did, knowing the ways that they paved is crucial. And it used to get passed down verbally. Now, because of the technology we have, you know, it's a quick Google search to find out what our ancestors did before us. But we've always been a people that would look at what was done before us to fuel us into what we're going to do moving forward. So the reason why Black history to me is so important is knowing what we come from can embolden us and inspire us into where we're supposed to go.
And
if we don't learn that history, it's another way of stagnating our growth. If we don't learn what we've gone through, what we've done, the great things that we've done, the perseverance that's been shown, in ways we start to forget what we're capable of. So that's why I love learning like this and just bringing up these wonderful people, because it just reminds me of what I can do. It reminds me of what my kids can do, and it reminds me of the importance there is of just learning Black history in general and sharing that.
Facts.
Yeah, definitely. Right. Facts. And speaking of, who you got, Crispin?
Okay, so my person that I definitely wanted to highlight is Shirley Chisholm.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so Shirley Chisholm to me is an interesting story, and you know, she has a movie that they just made about her not too long ago. It's on Netflix. So go check that out if you haven't, because it's amazing.
But, you know, what's the name of it?
She's
It's called Shirley.
Yeah, the movie is called Shirley, and it's starring Regina King. She plays Shirley Chisholm, and she does an amazing job portraying Shirley Chisholm. But just some quick facts about her, just to highlight her: she was the first Black woman in Congress. She made that historical leap in 1968. She was the first Black woman elected to U.S. Congress, and she represented the New York's 12th congressional district. So, as far as firsts, she was the first Black woman to basically hit Washington.
Wow.
Representing the state of New York. She also was the first Black woman to run for president. In 1972, she officially put her name in for the Democratic National Party to run for president. And her campaign slogan was unbought and unbossed. So her short time in Congress, she was able to see with her white and Black counterparts that there's a lot of things that influenced how those guys represented their constituents. And that fueled her into wanting to launch her own presidential campaign with that being her slogan, unbought and unbossed. So she was an absolute boss in her own right, and just amazing. So, you know, she was obviously an advocate for social justice. She advocated for education, civil rights, economic equality. She focused on issues that affected, you know, marginalized communities. Being who she was absolutely a member of one as well. She represented women and minorities primarily. Before her political career, though, before she hit Washington, she was a teacher. She was an educational consultant, and she earned a master's degree in education from Columbia University.
Wow.
So highly educated woman. And as she got into the realm of education, she started to realize the problems weren't necessarily going to be fixed in the classroom. They needed to be fixed higher than that. They needed to be fixed as far as on a federal level, how education was being administered across the board. So that caused her to, you know, move her sights a little bit higher. And she was able to earn her way into Congress and affect change on a broader scale.
Wow, that's awesome. Wait, man.
Yeah. What year was this? Was the 70s, you said?
68, right?
Yeah, well, she made it to Congress in 68.
68.
And, 4 years later, she was already trying to become president of the United States. She lost her first presidential campaign.
Wow.
Yeah.
You see, like, now that's like within a 12-year span. That's how, with 12 years, right? Someone wants to try to be president.
Yeah.
You know, or things where you couldn't even be in the same room. Wow.
Exactly.
That's pretty cool. That's,
yeah.
But it goes back to the point we were just talking about learning our history, what you were just saying, Chrisman, learning our history and using that history to grow into who we need to become. And I guarantee she drew on some of those stories that she heard about some of these Black figures that she knew about, that her family had told her about, to like do what she did to accomplish those things. So I think it's powerful. Mm-hmm. It's powerful.
Yeah. I mean, because if you do from 54, right, which is Brown versus Board of Education, like to 68. Do we know the year she was born? What year was she born? Do we know?
Oh, Shirley Chisholm?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Because I'm thinking.
She was born in, I just saw it.
Because from 54 to 68, she was born in, so she 24, was
1924, yeah.
So she would have been old enough to be aware of Brown versus Board of Education. She was affected by that. Yeah, she was definitely affected by that.
Absolutely. She was in the education system at that point as a teacher.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. So it just got like a ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Down.
Absolutely. That's awesome.
My guy I did a little bit of research on is in that same kind of thing. So did you know that the first Black senator was elected just 5 years after the Civil War ended?
What?
So the guy's name is Hiram Revels. And in 1870, he became the first person to take the U.S. Senate seat in Mississippi.
What? Wow. In Mississippi?
Yeah, Mississippi.
Wow. I mean, that's the thick of it.
Deep south. The thick of it.
And another part that's even that's crazy about this too is the seat that he took, the Senate seat that he took, mm-hmm. was actually held by someone named Jefferson Davis, and he was the president of the Confederacy.
Wow.
What?
Wow. Stick it to him. Dang. So. How would you be salty? The person that you've been that you literally do not want even exist took your spot.
Yeah.
Wait.
Wow.
I think there are some people in between, but like almost like once removed, he became, you know, like it was like a whole full circle moment.
Yeah.
Where he, you know, could barely vote, and then, you know, became a senator. But in the past it worked a little bit differently, where like senators weren't elected by popular vote. They were actually voted by the state legislators or something like that. Mm. And one of the things that was kind of crazy, like when I was researching him, is the people who voted against him were arguing that he hadn't been a citizen long enough to qualify to become a senator.
Bruh.
Even though he was born in North Carolina.
Bro, what?
So what did they deem a citizen back then?
Somebody that wasn't a slave, wasn't, I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, he was born free,
okay.
But he wasn't. I think this was before like the 3/5 thing. So he wasn't a full citizen.
He's only been a citizen for 2 years.
That's crazy.
But after he was a senator, I don't know how long he served for. I should look that up. But he became the president of Alcorn University, which is a historically black college.
So,
so he became one of the our president there.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So, wow. Yeah.
I feel like just from hearing both of your figures, we have to highlight, especially you're getting into the political reign of things, that there is a community behind. Because if most of the country ideals at that time were just like segregation and, you know, white superiority, there's no way these people would get in seats of politics. So there had to be some progressive minds that weren't black at that time. Now we're still rooting for these equality changes.
Yeah, they're definitely. Yeah, sure. I feel like a lot of people don't realize there was a lot of people that were in there that were behind the scenes that usually just don't get highlighted. Those white folks that were there helping push things forward, because there's always someone who's advocating to help us get into that seat and lobbying for that. So that's awesome.
Yeah. The highlight is just the struggle. I mean, because we had to struggle, you know, to get there. It's definitely still been a fight, and we're still fighting.
Yeah, but that happened 1870. So
1870.
Bruh.
Kind of close to, you know, the church.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Fun fact.
All he needed to know was we free and it's all.
Yeah.
Let's get to it.
Let's work.
Fun fact. You know, you guys know that movie Free State of Jones? You guys ever seen that?
Free State of Jones. I've seen that. Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah. I've seen that.
Oh, it's a good movie. Anyway, he kind of leads a revolution down there in Jones County. I think it's Mississippi, right?
Or Louisiana. Yeah.
I found out that his wife, the black girl that's in that movie that he married, she later on becomes a member of the church.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Isn't that crazy? But I was just thinking the Mississippi, I was just like, wow, that's interesting.
There you go. His truth is marching on. Love that. That's
what's up. Fun fact. Anyway, so who else got another thing that's been affected by this?
I got you.
Okay.
What you got?
All right. So this is a black female figure that I was impacted by. I first heard of her in elementary back in Indianapolis because they had a whole center dedicated to her.
Really?
And so apparently, so these are facts. So she's the first black female millionaire in the U.S. And kind of how she created her wealth was, well, let's talk a little bit about her upbringing. So she was born to enslaved parents in 1867.
Wow.
So kind of around the same time homeboy came senator in Mississippi a few years later, but born to enslaved parents. And later on in life, she started to develop hair loss. And so at that time, there wasn't really a lot of products, of course, but she started to tinker around with different products that they had back then and created her own hair product. And she started selling her hair product to other females, and they would have this almost like, makes me think of like Mary Kay, you know, like women get together.
Door to door selling stuff.
Yeah.
Multi-level marketing.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
First MLM.
So she created her own product and empowered women through that. You know, she taught them how to sell the product. She taught them how to apply the product to their hair. And I thought it was fascinating because you just don't hear about a lot of Black females at that time empowering themselves, especially during a time where, you know, there wasn't voting rights, you know, there wasn't equality and all these just different things that were meant to hold us back, but actually did the opposite to us. But yeah, I thought it was really fascinating for sure. So
that's cool. And that just shows you, like, no matter what your situation you're born in, it's up to you to change it. Like, you can change it. Yeah. You don't have to be the product of what you're born into. She had enslaved parents. I mean, it's very easy to say, okay, this is where I'm at. This is I'm not gonna be able to get out of this and stay there. But she innovated, she grew, she turned it into a business. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
What else? How can we apply that to our lives? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Wow. Remember, I saw this picture of her pushing
a pink Cadillac driving on the road, and I mean, with Mary Kay in the back window. Y'all got that from Madam CJ.
Yeah.
Have you seen that picture of her driving on the? She's driving like a Ford or something, like one of the Ford,
like a Model T
edition one. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, she's pushing like a Ford little, whatever. I don't even know what they called them things back in the day, the first Ford, but yeah.
Model T.
Yeah, Model T. Yeah, a little crank.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like no turning radius whatsoever. Yeah, absolutely.
Wood grain on the wheel. That's awesome. First millionaire. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
So, what about you, Isaiah?
So my figure I wanted to highlight was Nat Turner. We learned a little bit about him in our the work we did with Dr. Paul Reese. Oh, he told us a little bit about him. And I wanted to dig a little bit more into him because I had no idea. And he had a direct correlation of some of the events that happened with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at that time. And so for our audience that don't know, Nat Turner is known for basically having the first and biggest slave rebellion in the country, which lasted about 4 days. It was a 4-day rebellion upon where about 55 to 65 white people were killed in this rebellion that he had. But going backwards just a little bit, the reason for the rebellion, some things I didn't know is that Nat Turner, he was born a slave, but he was raised and he was educated. So he knew how to read. He knew how to write. He was a carpenter by trade, and he was actually a preacher in his time. And he actually had a congregation of people that he preached to. And a lot of his reasoning and the forefront of this rebellion that actually took place over a period of time, it was something that was drawn on him. He felt like he was inspired. And I have a few quotes I want to read just from his situation that kind of prompted him to lead up to this rebellion. And a lot of it stems from his faith, being a Christian and obviously being in a preacher, being in the Bible and looking at his surroundings at the time. He was an individual that was highly impressed by the world. Like, he believed that God was a creator and that God sent signs and omens through his creation. Mm. And so a lot of what he was seeing around him, he felt were signs.
Almost like Harriet Tubman. Sounds like,
yeah,
very similar.
Yeah, mm. Very similar.
Wow.
And he's not shy from explaining visions that he felt he had at the time.
Sounds familiar.
Another thing is, around this time was the Restoration. Like, because this was around, so the Restoration happened in 1820, or the process began in 1820 with Joseph Smith's first vision.
Yeah.
Nat Turner got really active between 1825 and 1830.
What?
And the church was organized in 1830.
Yeah, they were just getting the ball rolling.
Yeah.
Officially.
Exactly.
And wasn't he in Virginia?
Yeah.
So, Virginia. Oh, so not too far from Joseph. So not
too far from where a lot of the activity was happening with the church. Yeah. But yeah, these are a few things that I just wanted to share. So, so by the spring of 1828, Turner was convinced that he was ordained for some great purpose in the hands of the Almighty. By this time, he had already explained that he had had spiritual communications and felt impressed by what he says is the Holy Ghost. Hmm. Turner said he heard a loud noise in the heavens while working in the fields of May 12th of that year, and that the Spirit appeared to him and said that the serpent was loosened and Christ had laid down the yoke he had borne for the sins of men, and that he should take on the fight against the serpent, for the time was fast approaching when the first should be the last and the last should be first. Mm-hmm. And so Turner made it clear that he sees himself as participating in the confrontation between God's kingdom and the anti-kingdom that characterized his social historical context. Mm. So, wow. Yeah.
Man.
And so, learning from Dr. Paul Reeves, this happened in 1831, which is when the rebellion happened and ended. So the repercussions of the rebellion created a lot more fear and tightened restrictions with slaves, for slave owners at that time. And we learned through Paul Reeves that when the extermination order came through in Missouri from Governor Boggs, that they noticed there were a bunch of free slaves that were beginning to integrate and join the Latter-day Saints at that time in the state of Missouri, which was a slave state. And so the remembrance and fear of Nat Turner's rebellion began to incite the individuals of Missouri and Missourians at that time. And they were thinking there was going to be another big revolt.
Yeah.
And slave rebellion.
You got all these people multiplying like every day, and then you got slaves on top of that. Yeah. Everybody's scared.
Yeah.
And yeah. Like they're going to take us over.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so a huge part of that extermination order and driving the Saints out of Missouri was because of the repercussions of Nat Turner's slave rebellion and the fear of another uprising in the slaves.
Wow.
But to get the spiritual context behind his reasoning, because, you know, I remember hearing about Nat Turner's slave rebellion in school. Like in the history books, but we don't get like the full context around.
Well, they portray him as like a crazy man running around with a knife, you know, killing people. Yeah. You know, that's what I mean.
He did kill some folks, bro. It was a massacre, but yes.
Freddy Krueger's now.
So him personally, from what I researched, he actually only killed one person.
Oh, okay.
Of this 55 and 65 people, and he used a fence pole. The inside. He used a post.
Not sharp, just post. A pipe.
But the rest of the incites and murders came from the individuals that he was able to carouse and get to join him in his rebellion.
Wow,
man.
Yeah.
So that just had a rippling effect from the East Coast all the way to the Midwest. Of this mm-hmm.
And over years, because, I mean, I was in 31 and, you know, we know the extermination order for the Saints at the time came about 7 years later.
Mm. True. Yeah. And if you think about it too, the border state, Kansas, they were trying to make that a free state. And so them almost being, they know that just that borderline of right there, that they would have people on this on their one side and people on the other side trying to turn that state into becoming free. Because yeah, Kansas people and John Brown, I think that was his name. John Brown was this guy who was trying to stop slavery in Kansas and stuff like that. And so, yeah, Missouri was surrounded. I can see why they would try to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy, man.
And I feel like I didn't learn this until like early on, but I feel like in history, especially school history, like they like talk about, you know, our people, like they were like uneducated, didn't know how to do this and that, you know, they paint this picture like they were just dumb, you know? Mm-hmm. But when you hear these stories, there's so much power and it makes so much sense though. Like we're humans. Of course, we're going to think about something and try to resolve an issue. You know, that's the way we're naturally born, you know? Yeah. And so to hear these stories like Nat Turner or even Shirley Chisholm, like it's powerful. It's really powerful. Mm-hmm. It makes you want to go do something to like better yourself or help someone else out.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that wraps it up. The hearing all these stories is that when we hear about these people who innovated, who didn't settle, they used their agency. They believed in freedom. They believed in utilizing the opportunities they've been given and not becoming the product of their environment. That inspires us today. We can still continue to grow and still innovate and not become what we're surrounded by, you know? Yeah. And that's what inspires me. And I hope that people that are watching this are inspired and like, wow, these people are innovative. They can actually do things and not become of what they're surrounded by. You know,
mm-hmm.
You can apply this across any line. You don't have to be black. You can be white too and be inspired by these stories and know that these people don't settle.
Yeah.
I love that. And just black history is American history. Black history is world history. And people wonder why we say that because they think it sounds divisive when in fact it's not. For black people, especially in the United States, what we're battling is years of what we've done being hidden. These are facts that aren't widely educated. These are facts that aren't widely spread. This is research we had to do to find it, not research that's just given as part of the whole picture. And when we come from slavery here in the United States, where even our actual identities as far as our origin countries are taken from us, we're just vastly trying to pool together what we come from and what we've done. And black history, as we learn more about it, it's not just what did black people do for black people. As we look more at what some of these black people went through and have done to affect how laws are in the United States, we all reap the benefits from the work that was especially done in the Civil Rights Movement, let alone the groundwork that was laid before it. We all benefit from those laws now. And so if you don't teach what these people did, what these people were able to accomplish, then you don't have the full picture. Mm. And then we don't really know what America's history really is. And it's something to be treasured. It's not something to hide from. This is great stuff that these people did. People get caught up in the reasons that motivated them to get to this point, without being caught up in the ramifications of their hard work and the things we enjoy today because of their work. Mm-hmm. So that's what I love about diving into the black history. It's not all about, man, life sucked and look what they came from. It's more so like, man, I didn't realize that I enjoyed this now because of that. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that my kids can do this now because of that. I didn't realize that black people or a black person in particular was at the forefront of such a enormous commodity that we now enjoy across the entire country or even the world.
Mm, right. Most definitely.
Yeah, man. I think that's what brings it so important for us to do our family history, to figure out who you're connected to, because everyone has a story. You don't have to come from some legacy or come from some person that changed history. Every single person at home has someone that's connected who decided to make a pivot that made a ripple effect for your life and then made you why you're here. There was someone in the gospel or someone who was approached by a missionary that said, yeah, I'm going to do it. And then they affected you and or you're that person who decided to, like Isaiah, you decided to listen to the missionaries and talk to them. But your parents, it started with your parents first, you know, have planting that seed, you know. And so everyone here is affected by someone in their line that decided to take that first step, family or not. We're all affected by it. And so one eternal round, you know. So thank you guys for sharing these stories. I think this was really inspirational. I think we all learned something here. I definitely did. And if you did learn something today, please like and share this video. We'll be having some more clips of this, of individual stories that you guys can learn from. Again, thank you so much for tuning in. This is another episode with Brothers in the Foyer. We got more to come. And if you like this episode, please choose to support us. We are continually trying to grow and reach more people and being able to share more stories like this that are inspiring and helping those come closer to Christ and come to know themselves as well. And so if you feel inclined to, you can use the super thanks that's down there at the bottom of the video, or follow the links that are down in the description and be able to donate to our cause. Thank you so much. See you guys in the next one. Inviting all to come and try.